I'm Brian Russo, and welcome back to Coastal Connection. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll take you to one of the oldest ferries in the country as it gets ready to kick off its 331st season here on the shore. But first, we'll continue our Faith on the Coast series. This weekend is, of course, very notable for Christians all over the world, as Good Friday leads to Easter Sunday, which celebrates the resurrection of Christ. And with that idea of celebration and resurrection in mind, I decided this week to go back to St. Paul's by the Sea Episcopal Church in Ocean City, Maryland. Last November, a homeless man with a history of mental illness doused himself in gasoline, walked into the church's rectory, and lit himself on fire. The fire engulfed the front of the century-old church and claimed the life of its pastor, Reverend David Dingwall. But members of St. Paul's congregation have carried on and are getting ready to celebrate Easter like other Christians, even as they deal with their own lingering grief. Reverend Dr. Mark Sear has been named the church's priest in charge, and I sat down with him earlier this week. We talked about what it's been like to navigate a group of believers through this unbelievably tough time.
It was very somber, and people were really not sure of who they were or where they were going. They had lost their leader, and so they were looking for some stability, some sense of direction.
Of course, whenever there's a tragedy, not only does it, you know, affect the everyday, the day-to-day, the human, just your personal relationships, but you would think that for a church, it would also challenge faith and their belief in God and belief that God has a plan for everybody. Mm-hmm. How did you help members of this congregation sort of work through those questions?
Well, actually, we're still working through those questions, and those are ever present, you know, because in life we have good times and bad times. I mean, tragedy happens to everybody, but something so drastic as, you know, having the rectory burn down and your priest die is major, and so it affects people on multiple levels, because a lot of people here were friends of Father David, and he was also their spiritual director, and he was the one to whom they turned for guidance and for assistance, whether that was friendship or financial assistance or whatever. He was always there for them. Mm-hmm. He directed their ministries, the outreach to the poor and the homeless, and the Red Doors ministry, which is an attempt to reach out to families and to people who are spiritual in creative ways. They use the arts to express themselves. And so we're opening the doors, the Red Doors, to these people so that they have a sense of the inclusiveness of St. Paul's by the Sea, and that this is a place for them as well as for anybody else.
When you were asked to take on the role of priest in charge, first, I guess let's identify what that exactly means. What does a priest in charge do?
Well, when I first came here, I was a supply priest. A supply priest basically just comes on Sunday and does the service and, you know, stays for the coffee hour, and maybe if you need to bring somebody communion at home, the supply priest will do that. Priest in charge has all the authority and the responsibility of being a rector, but doesn't have the tenure. In other words, when a priest in the Episcopal Church is asked to be the rector of a church, they basically have a contract for life. Mm-hmm. There's no end point. For a priest in charge, it's a year-by-year contract, that can be terminated even before a year by mutual agreement.
Sure. And of course, in many congregations, even those who don't lose their pastor through tragic circumstances, sometimes, you know, ministers or pastors or priests, they move on and they go to take a call in another church, right, in another place. So that congregation goes out on a search, or they put out calls themselves to other people. Is this church doing that now?
At this point, we are not actively searching for a new minister. When I first was called by the bishop, the bishop and I talked about whether I should be the interim, which is the in-between priest who helps them search for a new minister, or whether I should be the priest in charge. And we both agreed that it would be better for me to be the priest in charge, so that the congregation doesn't feel like they have to move on before they're ready to find a new priest.
Right.
So this is kind of a in-between time where everybody can get settled, deal with the tragedy, start moving on, deal with the property that we've got to deal with, that burned out building, and it just gives everybody some breathing room.
Yeah.
So we're not in any hurry to find the permanent replacement.
You mentioned the rectory in the front where the fire took place. I know there was a recent decision or a vote or a collaborative, you know, effort to decide on what to do with it, whether to rebuild or whether to tear down. The decision, from what I understand, has been made to essentially tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
Why did the congregation think that it was time to start anew and to take that down? Was it part of the healing process?
Yes, it's absolutely part of the healing process. I don't think that most of the people consciously recognized that when the decision was made. In actuality, the congregation was split about 50-50 for people who wanted to renovate and rebuild what we had and tear down and build something new. The decision to tear down and build something new was pretty much reached by the leadership of the parish, the vestry, because in the discussion of what to do and how to proceed, it was recognized that there would be a lot more options available for us as far as how to configure the space, what to do, and to create a space that was more what the parish needed in order to fulfill the ministries that we're involved in. Putting it back the way it was, rebuilding that same rectory with the same rooms, same configuration, it wasn't working good before, and so it wouldn't have been a good use of the space.
For you personally, were you hesitant at all, knowing what a tough time this congregation was going through when you were offered the priest in charge role? Did you have a moment of questioning whether or not you were the guy for the job? And I guess, how did you get past that?
Yeah, I took this job with trepidation. I mean, it's a mighty calling to come into such a situation with people who are very attached to their rector and who are dealing with the tragedy and the loss. And I wondered if I should take it. And yet it was very exciting, and I knew that I could deal with it. Mm-hmm. I knew that I was had been given that I have the right gifts that God has given me in my experience in the past, and that when I first came here at Supply, I just developed a relationship immediately with the people and knew that this was a special place that I would fit in and would feel good.
How would you assess how the congregation has reacted? I've spoken to a few people in the congregation who have said that in the wake of what has happened, some people have taken what has happened and are trying to work through their feelings or their grief by becoming more involved.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing that this congregation is banding together and becoming more involved and perhaps even, you know, a stronger unit collectively?
Absolutely. Absolutely, which is one of the things that I'm very impressed with this congregation. In the midst of the tragedy, people just stepped forward to take leadership roles, to become involved, to do what was necessary, to make the decisions that were difficult but necessary to make, and to keep the ministries of the church going. Even though we've lost a lot of space, we've had to make do. We can't even worship in our church or sanctuary because it's still being cleared out of smoke and full of scaffolding right now, which actually they're in the process of taking down as we speak, which is good.
During Palm Sunday last week,
mm-hmm.
where, and perhaps in preceding Sundays before that, where has worship been taking place? In this room here?
In the parish hall. We've set up a table that we use as an altar, and we set up chairs in the parish hall, and we, you know, process up the aisle and use the table as the altar, and we have candles. We have everything that we would have in the church, not as fancy, not as, you know, nice, but it works.
Yeah.
And the people are very receptive to it. And we've had good attendance. People have shown up, not only regular attendees, but people who are visitors who come to Ocean City for a weekend or whatever, and they come and join us. And everybody, it's a family. The other thing that's important to realize is that before the tragedy, there were two services, 8 o'clock and a 10:30 service. After the tragedy, it was decided to just do one service at 9 o'clock. Just that one act has really pulled people together. Mm-hmm. People who were worshiping separately are now worshiping together, and there's a bond that's been created. People who didn't even know each other very well are developing that relationship, that friendship, and sharing that tragedy together. The other thing that's important to know is that we've had a grief counselor come in a couple times to speak to those who want to process their feelings. As a priest in charge, I can't do everything. I don't want to do everything. It's beyond me. But I do what I can, and it's important to call in others who can supplement and do what else needs to be done.
As we approach Easter weekend, and of course anyone you know that follows Christianity or has been to a Christian church knows that certainly Easter and Christmas are the two biggest weekends or major events in that particular faith. Do you feel like the congregation is looking forward to and is ready to celebrate everything that is celebrated in the Easter season, this sort of resurrection of Christ and sort of the rebirth of hope, so mm-hmm. to speak?
Christians are a resurrection people, and that is especially true here at St. Paul's by the Sea because of the tragedy we've been through, but also the sharing of the Lenten season, which leads up to Holy Week and the Passion of our Lord, and the trials and tribulations that he faced, because we have been affected so seriously by this tragedy, we relate a little bit closer to what Jesus went through. And so on Easter Sunday, when we celebrate the Alleluia, He is risen, there's absolutely a sense that we are also, as a congregation and as individuals, rising from despair into hope and new life and all that God, the blessings that God gives us.
It seems as I speak to people in this congregation and just seeing kind of the activity going on in this parish hall this morning, that there is sort of a resurgence and there is hope and people are starting to get filled with it. How much hope does that give you leading this church that you're steering them in the right direction?
Oh, it's a tremendous source of comfort and help for me to see the people responding to the sense that there is new life coming.
The sense I get in chatting with you here is that, you know, certainly this tragedy rocked this congregation and this community, and it tested a lot of people's faith. Mm-hmm. But do you think that in the face of tragedy that faith can actually be made stronger? And I feel that here.
Absolutely. When you go through a life event, whether it be an accident or a bout of cancer or anything that dampens your spirits, and you start getting out of that and you see the light at the end of the tunnel, there's a sense of strength that comes with that. And if you can grab onto that, it'll help you be a stronger person on the other side. And that's really a sense of who we are here at St. Paul's.
That was Reverend Dr. Mark Sear, the priest in charge at St. Paul's by the Sea Episcopal Church in Ocean City, Maryland.
On a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, the emblem.
We'll end today's show in Oxford, Maryland, where this weekend the town's ferry service will reopen for the 2014 season. The Oxford Bellevue Ferry was established 331 years ago when Talbot County ordered its creation to move horses and men across the Tread Avon River. During the boom years of the seafood industry, the ferry also took cannery workers back and forth to jobs on both sides of the river. These days, though, the ferry caters more to tourists than to commuters. People from places like Washington, D.C. or Baltimore who come to Oxford looking to enjoy the quiet side of life on the Chesapeake Bay. Coastal Connection's Tara Boyle caught up this week with the owners of the Oxford Bellevue Ferry to learn more about its long history and sent us this audio postcard.
Engines on.
Hi, I'm Judy Bixler. I'm president and owner of the Oxford Bellevue Ferry.
I'm Captain Tom Bixler, also the owners of the Oxford Ferry.
We started originally in 1683 when the county called upon Richard Royston to provide a ferry service for this area. That was back in 1683, before America came about. So we've been around for a long time. This will actually be 331 years for the Oxford-Bellevue Ferry.
What it was a barge that they used to scull, which is basically rowing, and or pulled across by rope. Unfortunately, in those days, it was people that were probably slaves at that point. The area was utilized, this ferry was utilized because it was a home port for the eastern shore of the United States, and the tobacco industry was shipping lots of tobacco and farm products at that point.
The ferry has been owned by a number of different people over the years, but there were a number of women actually who owned the ferry. And one of the famous women was Judith Bennett, and she actually outlived three husbands running the ferry. So I often tease my husband Tom that he better be careful, since I'm Judy and she was Judy. He better beware.
Brief 1 foot chance of rain through the night. The marine forecast for Chesapeake Bay from Poole's Island to Sandy.
We're standing on the bridge of the ferry. Doesn't get any prettier. The sun's shining, 75 degrees. We overlook the harbor of Oxford and the Tredavon River. And then we get to enjoy all the wildlife and all the folks that come to visit us. So what could be better?
Tonight, south winds 15 to 20 knots.
We get lots of eagles, lots of osprey. We've had numerous instances where there was actually dolphins, porpoises, swimming in the river. One day, Judy actually had about 75 of them surrounding her, which was an odd experience, way up the river like this inside the bay. But there is always lots of ducks and geese and, many, many things roaming around. We've actually had deer swimming across the river, so there's no lack of wildlife.
In order to remove our gate, we use a large nail that holds the gate in place, and then it's counterbalanced, so it's quite tall. It's almost 25 feet long, but it's not that heavy because it's counterbalanced, so I can move the gate without too much trouble. Unless the wind is really strong, then sometimes I really have to put some effort into it. Tom was involved in working on a ferry when he was in college. It was his summer job, and he said that someday when we retired, this is what he'd like to do, own a ferry. And I think if you ask people back when I was growing up if they ever thought I'd be a ferry boat captain, they would have laughed at you. But it's really a spectacular job. We meet people from all over the world. And we actually came here, moved to this area in order to own the ferry.
We are the oldest privately held ferry in the United States. There is one other ferry, a lovely little operation up in Rocky Hill, Connecticut, which precedes us by about 13 years, but they've had the great luxury of being subsidized by the state of Connecticut. We've had to make this thing work with, just us.
The ferry is very stable. People don't understand that actually it gets more stable the more weight it has aboard it. They get out here when the waves are running and they're saying, oh, is it going to be bad? Am I going to get seasick? The ferry runs along very smoothly. You don't feel the motion. It's a wonderful vessel and you feel very secure aboard it, but it is a responsibility. So we're always on guard, paying attention. And then we're dancing with other sailboats. We're running with the watermen. It's kind of like an orchestra out here. We go in circles around each other and it's a neat experience. It really is something very special.
That was Judy and Tom Bixler speaking with Coastal Connections' Tara Boyle. If you want to see what the ferry looks like or check out its schedule for the upcoming season, we've got more information on our website, wamucoast.org. You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington. I'm Brian Russo.